We are just coming off two back-to-back high-profile suicides in 1 week, that of celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain and fashion designer Kate Spade. Both hung themselves, leaving their families and fans in disbelief. The cases come as the Center for Disease Control released a report on the spike in suicide cases across the country. Joining us to talk about Hawaii's numbers, Dr. Janelle Sugimoto Matsuda. She's with the University of Hawaii's Department of Psychiatry and the head of the Suicide Prevention Task Force.
We have seen some increasing trends both in Hawaii as well as other states and nationally. So the CDC did release their report last week, and it just so happened to come out during the news of the two high-profile suicides that we are seeing upward trends nationally as well.
Mm-hmm. And so explain why all of Hawaii's numbers weren't included in that CDC report.
Mm-hmm. So for some of the details of where they get that data, the CDC runs a program called the National Violent Death Reporting System. And currently, all 50 states are included. Hawaii became a participant about a year or two ago. So while the report was just released, the analysis, the really details of kind of the contextual information around suicides pulled from older data that they had when Hawaii was not yet participating. That's not to say Hawaii doesn't have data. We have some tracking data within our state for suicide deaths, attempts, hospitalizations, things like that. But now we will be putting that data into the national system to be able to compare a little bit more accurately across states and be part of that national system.
So share with our listeners, what is the snapshot here in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm. Basically, if you break it down to the most simplest way to say it, it's one every 2 days. One every 2 days for suicides across all ages. And that's not to say we have the highest rate in the nation. We don't. But of course, any suicide is a terrible tragedy that we want to try to prevent. But that's what we're looking at. And I think that surprises a lot of people because we don't talk about it. We don't publicize when suicides occur for different reasons. But generally, it's not a topic that, you know, is dinner table conversation where we're saying, hey, you know, what about this issue? What about mental health? What about suicide prevention? So it is surprising to many people, even professionals in the community.
Well, as a general rule, I know most media, you know, they don't really report these cases unless there's some unusual circumstance, just because they don't want copycats. And I even know with the police, you know, it's more the cases of dead on arrival, and they don't really publicize a lot of that.
Right. We thank the media for using what we call safe messaging. And safe messaging essentially means it's not that you can't talk about suicide. We actually want to talk about it because how are we going to prevent it if we can't even talk about it? But we do want to encourage media, journalists, and just anybody who is putting things on websites or social media to look at safe messaging guidelines. They're readily available online. And basically, the general things that you want to provide are hope, help, resources, and warning signs. You know, give that basic information whenever you are publishing anything about suicide. And we want to ask people to avoid, you know, overly graphic, overly detailed information because really the public doesn't need to know that information. We want to avoid glamorizing it, that everybody's doing it kind of messages. And we also want to ask people, you know, don't simplify causes to say, well, this one incident occurred and then the person made their suicide attempt. It's never that simple.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated.
So and often we don't know the reasons.
Exactly, which is one of the unfortunate, you know, frustrations around this issue.
So what are we doing as a state to deal with this problem?
Mm-hmm. So I'm currently chairing the Prevent Suicide Hawaii Task Force. We are a community-based network of providers, of organizations, and just of individual community members across the state. We have partners on all the different islands. And just we're kind of the hub or the network for folks to come together and coordinate efforts around suicide prevention and mental health and mental wellness. And we do partner very closely with the Department of Health. They're sort of our designated state lead for suicide prevention. And they guide us through planning of activities and awareness campaigns. We're right now planning for a big statewide conference in April 2019, so that's coming up, to just, you know, continue to spread awareness, get people talking about it, you know, and sharing information, because I know we're not always good at that, but to get providers and community to come together. We also recently were asked to and presented a strategic plan to the state legislature to try to reduce suicides 25% by the year 2025. And there's a national campaign encouraging all states to reduce 20% by 2025. But our hope, our ideal is slightly higher than the national. So the task force put together some recommendations that we presented to the legislature to get some, you know, higher level support and organization and coordination around this effort.
And so I know just myself, I know of families who've suffered the loss of their children, you know, because of suicide. And that's pretty traumatic, because you always think you're going to outlive your children. And yet I know many people, many families are struggling with this. What's the snapshot for suicide in young people?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that while the suicide death rate for youth is, when we look by ages, is not the highest, the suicide attempt rate and the risk for attempts as well as thinking about suicide is quite high in young people. And young people, meaning from 10 all the way up to even early 20s, is kind of a high risk time frame for folks. And, you know, not just young people and just developmentally and all those things, but of course when you think about transitioning from high school to life or adulthood or workforce or college or whatever it may be, that transition time period can also be a high risk period.
So is there anything that we need to know as parents to help our children with the coping skills?
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely you hit it on the head right there with coping skills. And, you know, even as adults we have coping skills, some of which are positive and some of which are not so positive, but just really encouraging that dialogue, being open with your children, not shutting off conversations around mental health or just talking about feelings and those kinds of things. And it's so taboo already in our society. So as parents, how can we just say to our children, you know, I'm here, you can talk to me, I'm not going to be judgmental about if you talk about this is how I'm feeling or this is what happened or whatever, that I'm somebody that you can talk to. And really encouraging not just parents, right, but adults in general to be open. If you work in a school or you work with youth, to be willing and open to just talk story and have that kind of conversation.
I know sometimes folks say that there are helicopter parents who swoop in and rescue their children, but then those children don't learn to be resilient and don't know how to cope. And so when something major happens, they fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a careful balance, right? Supporting them, being open to having that conversation. But not just children, adults in general, right? We need to talk more about the resilience factor. And more of the suicide prevention and mental health field is moving away from the risk, but more into how can we bolster people's coping skills? How can we get them to be more resilient in light of, we know that life stressors will happen, but how can we build up that positive side, the resilience, to have people get better coping skills and also still keeping the conversation open?
And then what about for adults then, let's say for seniors?
Mm-hmm.
There's a large number that deal with depression.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do if we see our kupuna, our aunties and our uncles or our parents, mm-hmm. Suffering and dealing with depression?
Yeah, I think, I hate to keep coming back to it, but it really is still opening the conversation and not saying, well, the kind of they've lived a good life kind of thing, and so we shouldn't look for depression in our seniors or our elders, but definitely they're a high-risk group as well. When you think about transition periods being a time to check in on somebody, you know, retirement from workforce into whatever is planned thereafter, really looking at those transitions to say, do they have plans? How can we make sure that they've still got support networks despite leaving an organization that they've worked for 30 years? And also still, like I said earlier, being open to, hey, yeah, seniors may do suffer from depression, and it's not just something we should ignore because, you know, they're older or farther along in life, but it's something that we definitely need to still keep an eye on.
And then a lot of our communities are dealing with disasters, the trauma of the recent flooding, the trauma of the volcano. A lot of folks are displaced, they're homeless. So we just kind of need to pay attention to their mental health issues.
Most definitely. Many of our partners have been on the ground on the different islands responding to shelters, responding, being with families just during this time. And just as we were discussing earlier, making sure that our responders also have some kind of support network. They have time away so that they can kind of recoup, do some self-care, and come back and still be able to support these families. But unfortunately, you know, with the limited number of mental health providers, social support providers, we are seeing, we're trying to be careful about burnout and compassion fatigue and those kinds of things.
Right, because caregivers need care too.
Absolutely, in order to do the best out there that they can in the field.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this morning.
No, thank you very much.
Dr. Janelle Sugimoto-Matsuda is assistant professor at the University of Hawaii Medical School. She shares that there is a free conference open to the public underway in Waikiki. That's today and tomorrow for those interested in training. You can find links to that and other local resources on our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, discovering the financial benefits of albizia wood in construction. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a pioneer of the visitor industry who came to Hawaii in the 1870s from Greece. He was a hotelier who bought a small guest cottage on Waikiki Beach in 1893. He expanded it and named it Sans Souci, French for without care. It was one of the island's first beach resorts. He later bought and managed Volcano House on Hawaii Island. Members of the Hawaiian royal family were regular guests at his resorts, and his continued support for the monarchy in the wake of the 1892 overthrow put him at odds with supporters of the newly formed Republic of Hawaii. After the failed 1895 counter-revolution, he was accused of smuggling guns to the royalists, many of whom had attended meetings in his Sans Souci Hotel. He was arrested and charged with treason. Although he spent 52 days in jail, he was never tried. This morning, we're looking for the name of this colorful figure. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hawaii has some of the highest construction costs in the nation, but what if there was a source of cheap, locally produced building material that was also good for the environment? It turns out there may in fact be one, wood. Joseph Valenti is an architect and project leader for the Hawaii Wood Utilization Team. He recently completed a prototype structure built entirely from albizia, a fast-growing invasive. Our producer Ryan Finnerty went to the unveiling to speak with Joseph and other members of Hawaii's forest industry to learn what comes next.
We will be looking at different species. So taking a step away from Albizia and looking at toon, eucalyptus, and pine, different species of pine. So with those, we'll be exploring how they perform and strength testing them, similar to how this was done, but seeing their specific applications, so what they can be used for, such as structural material or cladding, accessory materials, and just really fine-tuning that and putting that into an actual structure.
And what is the directory that you mentioned, the wood products directory that you're working on?
So the directory is essentially, that's a HFIA's project, and they'll be organizing all these companies and businesses related to the industry into a directory, so it makes the community more educated and aware and really starts to connect the dots between an industry that at the moment is really disorganized. There's a lot of missing links from processing to supply and demand, and what that directory really wants to do is bring those together and make it more transparent and more available for people to be involved. So I think that's it's a good way to put it onto a database, basically, where people have access and are aware of what we have here.
How do you like working with wood compared to other materials?
I love working with wood. The craftsmanship and the attention to detail you get with working from wood, I think it doesn't compare in terms of what you can do with that versus other materials. There's a huge sustainability push right now, and that's a big plus for utilizing wood, especially here in Hawaii, because we have so much wasted wood species happening. And we're really trying to capture that and start to look at how we can innovate and think differently about it.
What are some of the species that go to waste here in Hawaii?
I think number one or the hot topic right now is Albizia, and that's why my project started there. And not only is it going, you know, it's being taken down significantly and being disposed of, but it's also... there's so much of it, and the state needs to get rid of it. They want to get rid of it. So it's just going to get, you know, become more and more of an issue until we find ways to utilize it, or at least work around costs of removing it. So if we can incentivize that removal, then that's where I think we're solving it. But that is just one species. And with this grant, we're looking at so many other species, or several other species, I should say, eucalyptus and toon and pine, and each of those has various subspecies within them. So if you look at Kauai, if you look at Big Island, there's massive forests of it, and the issue we're having is not utilizing it, and it was planted for a purpose, and that just never really took off. So we want to kind of resurface that and help to heal our forest, because if we're not utilizing this stuff, we have issues of overgrowth, and that leads to so much other issues, so many other issues, fire hazards and whatnot. So
a lot of people don't know that Hawaii has one of the highest rates of wildfire in the country. How is this project going to affect that?
Well, what we're hoping is if we can demonstrate the availability of these materials here and start to create a market pull for it and a demand, then essentially what we had highlighted is, one, the ADU unit, the prototype we're going to build, we want to try to really emphasize the use of wood throughout it, and not only for utilizing material, but to express its beauty and show that it has so much potential that's really untapped right now. And then if that were to become a product, then from there we would be essentially creating a demand, which would start to incentivize a growth in our industry, which we would need more mills and we would need more infrastructure to really get this going. I think there's a dynamic there where you know, we need a demand, but we need a supply. And I think with that to happen, you need the two to happen simultaneously. So that's what we're trying to find that balance between the two.
And since you mentioned supply and demand, do you know how does wood compare to other building materials in terms of cost, either imported wood or local wood?
In terms of cost for other building materials, it's competitive, and there's a lot of variations. So right now, I think, if you look at local material, it's really hard to compete, not only with other materials, but with wood itself imported.
But you expect that will change if you can scale this industry up through this project.
Exactly, and that's what we're trying to explore and trying to push for, because if you are able to grow our demand and grow our infrastructure at the same time, then you basically have the scaling of it that allows it to be significantly reduced.
But before locally produced wood can become viable on a large scale, foresters and mills will need to scale up. Michael Tam is president and CEO of Martin & MacArthur and sits on the board of the Hawaii Forest Industry Association. He told me that Hawaii's wood industry originally began with koa, but is now dependent on imports.
The vast majority of wood that's used in construction and architecture now does not come from Hawaii. Surprisingly, with all the wood that's available here and the fact that we're trying to utilize that wood to prevent forest fires and so forth, most of the wood is not coming from Hawaii. It's coming from the mainland and from Asia. And so it's really important for us to take advantage of the resources that we have here, just for the betterment and the sustainability of the wood industry here in Hawaii, but also for the protection of that wood industry as well.
And are there any challenges associated with using some of the wood species available here versus the more conventional ones that come in from the mainland or elsewhere?
A lot of the wood species that we have here in Hawaii are actually the same ones that you could actually get from the mainland. Douglas fir and so forth. And so what we want to be sure is that people realize that by milling and utilizing this wood, you could actually take advantage of helping Hawaii too. The difference is a lot of times the mainland wood is already milled and already in perfect board feet and so forth. And so in order for the industry to grow, there needs to be a need for it. And the building industry needs to show that their use of it is going to allow us to establish those kinds of milling operations here for that wood as well.
What kind of demand in the building industry are you seeing for wood-based construction versus concrete or some other material?
Well, obviously, concrete is going to be by far the largest because many of the buildings now are high-rises and so forth. But wood is used as an accent and used for smaller buildings significantly, and even more so. The industry is realizing that consumers, residents, and even offices want to use something sustainable, and concrete is not sustainable. Plastic is not sustainable. Petroleum is not sustainable. And so the wood industry has a great opportunity to take advantage of the current trends within society to use something that's sustainable. And we want to find a way to not eradicate or eliminate the use of concrete and steel, obviously not, but we want to use wood as a component of building more so than it is now.
And where in Hawaii are large reserves, forest reserves found? Where would most of this type of forestry for wood production be found?
The most amazing thing is you can imagine that our youngest island, the Big Island, has the vast majority of the wood. But because Hawaii is so lush, there are woods that we can use in Kauai and on Oahu and on the and in Maui as well. But the Big Island has the largest amount of sustainable wood that we can harvest for the building industry.
And when it comes to cultivating forestry in Hawaii long term, you have to be planting new trees. Do you know what type of supply we currently have on hand?
Ironically, in the forest industry, you really don't have to be actively planting trees, because And taking koa, for example, when we, Martin MacArthur, takes a dead koa tree out of the forest and we fence off the area where that tree was, that dead tree was, it allows all the new koa trees to grow. And frankly, the koa pods and the pods from all of these trees are there in the ground now. They're dormant because a lot of them are underneath dead trees and dead brush. And that's why taking and utilizing trees is going to allow the forest to regrow and get stronger. And so there's not an active planting that actually has to happen for the forest industry. It does it itself, and that's the natural way it happens.
And how large is the forestry industry in Hawaii between harvesting wood and actually milling it into lumber?
The industry is not large as it should be because the industry is not being utilized as much for building purposes, and we're looking to grow that exponentially.
You can see the prototype Albizia structure on the UH Manoa campus at the corner of University Avenue and Campus Road. To see the photos, head over to the Conversation Facebook page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kupono from the band Jamarek, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Primary election is just 2 months away, and we're learning more about money being spent in the campaigns in some of the more competitive races. That's the subject of the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle has a story about a super PAC that he's been tracking. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how's it going?
So tell us about what's happening here.
Well, we're seeing a little over or almost $250,000 getting dumped into the LG race from a super PAC called Be Change Now. It was formerly All Hawaii Stand Together until recently. That's to buy about a bunch of ads on four different TV stations, all to support Josh Green's candidacy.
So why the name change?
The name got changed, we think anyway, as best we can tell, because All Hawaii Stand Together, the iconic song, the artist, Liko Martin, who put that together, was not exactly happy with them using the title of his song for a super PAC that's kind of completely against everything he kind of stands for and believes in.
So why the LG's race? Because you'd think that that's really not a position that has a whole lot of power, but I don't know.
That's such a good question. We're not seeing these kind of super PACs step into the governor's race, at least at this point, or other higher offices. So as best we can tell, there's a couple things. One, the LG position has been a major stepping stone to higher office in the past. I think there's at least three prior governors were LGs before. But then also there's some speculation from Colin Moore, a political analyst, who's saying, well, let's support Josh, but also let's potentially punish Jill Takuta with this because she had kind of a hardline stance on rail when she was the Senate Ways and Means Chair. And, of course, the super PAC is funded by the Carpenters Council, which is very much pro-rail.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I almost forgot about that. That was pretty contentious because she lost her position over that.
Yeah.
And so we're not seeing, though, a lot of money thrown into other races just yet.
Not yet, but we're going to be continuing to watch that. I mean, at this point, this is the biggest one in terms of outside money that I've seen so far. We're seeing, you know, Senator Green and Senator Takuta being prepared to put a lot of their own money, about $250,000 and $300,000 respectively. But I'd keep an eye out because I think there's going to be some more in the future.
Right, and we did see the PACs, with, I think, PRP in the mayor's race and some of the tricks, the dirty tricks that we saw during the campaign.
Oh, absolutely. I think they put about $4 million into the past three elections of outside money. And the mayor's race, of course, was the most famous. It ended up with them getting fined and then having to issue this big public apology to former Governor Cayetano, the candidate in the race who ultimately lost to now Mayor Caldwell.
So do you have a prediction? Do you think we're going to see some more dirty tricks as we get closer?
I don't know what to expect exactly. It's possible, but I would look for a blitz of ads from, at a minimum, Green's campaign and Tokuda's campaigns.
Okay. All right. Well, we will watch for that, Nathan Eagle. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read more about his story, visit SybilBeat.org.
Tales of tragic love, of bullies and bears, and of the goddess Pele? Hear all of them told by master storyteller Jeff Gere in HPR's intimate Atherton studio on Saturday, the 23rd. Enjoy fresh tales on an old tongue by calling 955-8821 during business hours or going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It was a detour, thanks to Madame Pele. The closure of Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island meant that school groups planning a field trip as part of their Hawaiian history had to divert to Oahu for their end-of-the-year trip. We were there when fourth graders from Kauai visited the only intact heiau in urban Honolulu last month. The Manoa Heritage Center was able to welcome them into their new education hale and visitor center. For Mary Cook, it was a fulfillment of a decades-old vision she shared with her late husband, Sam Cook, for their 3.5-acre Manoa estate, which includes a historic home. The new hale cements the future of the center, so visits like this one from the Kauai students can continue. Kikaha fourth graders prepared an oli, a chant they presented as they stepped foot onto the grounds of the Manoa Heritage Center.
So this is a new place, and you guys are one of the first groups from Kauai to come here.
Wow. The staff, including director Jessica Welch, happily welcomed them to the new visitor center and education hale.
Today we have a group from Kikaha Elementary on Kauai, and they're here because they were scheduled to go do the fourth grade pilgrimage to see the volcano. And that trip had to be rescheduled. And so they came here to kind of make up for that. And so they're here to learn about Hawaiian history, Hawaiian culture. The group is out at the heiau, learning about the agricultural heiau, in the garden, learning about the native plants. And they're also doing some service learning in the garden itself. The most fun thing is to see people experiencing the space, so school groups like today coming here and to see the kids running around and to see them learning and doing what we kind of designed the space to do. And there are a lot of surprises. You know, kids are learning in ways that we didn't anticipate as well. But it is fun. It was very fun to be part of the project kind of from the ground up and to build this space and not to see it being used is just the most fun part.
And then we were out on the landing upstairs at the house, and the kids were out in the garden, and there was a double rainbow.
I don't know, things like that happen here, and I think it's really special when you see, you know, this kind of blessing for this special group that's with us here today.
Back up at the main house where benefactress Mary Cook resides, she reflected on the family dream finally coming true. You're very fortunate to be able to look out, you know, the doors here and see the school kids walking through here every day.
Yes, yes. Well, this property was Sam's grandparents. They were given it as a wedding present in 1901, 20 acres. It's now 3.5, so it's shrunk considerably. But it's always been in the family. This historic home that I live in will eventually, when I'm gone, be part of Manoa Heritage Center and be open to the public for views as well. But the most important thing is the heiau, because it's the only one now that's still intact. And it was an agricultural heiau. It's small, but all of Manoa was taro lo'i and sweet potatoes. Now it's all residences. But it looks out. It's situated on a hill that looks out over the whole valley. You can look all the way up to Lion Arboretum and all the way down to Waikiki and see Diamond Head from the heiau. This house was built in 1911, so it's 107 years old. And when the plumber came, and I had two things on my list that I'd asked him to come and do, this is maybe 20 years ago. And when he got here, I had maybe 8 things on my list. And he said, "Oh, no more in, no?" So that's my motto. When you live in an old house, there's an endless number of things that you have to do. So right now we need to paint the outside. The roof is being repaired. That's where the beep beep noises are coming from. But we celebrated our 50th anniversary, wedding anniversary. Puakea Nogomeyer wrote a beautiful special kuli'i chant for us. So Sam passed away 2.5 years ago, and I'm sure he's up there smiling down and saying, "Good job."
And that chant, composed in the couple's honor, was performed at the recent opening of the Hale, a mahalo and aloha for a Kama'aina family giving back to the community. This summer, the center launches a series of community workshops, including moon studies with a closer look at the Hawaiian lunar calendar. For information about the Manoa Heritage Center, which offers school tours in the morning and adult tours in the afternoon, check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a Greek settler in the Hawaiian Islands who lived from 1858 to 1960 and left his mark on the local visitor industry. His Sanssouci Hotel on Waikiki Beach became one of Hawaii's first resorts and was a popular meeting place for members of the royal family and their supporters during the turbulent years of the overthrow and the failed counter-revolution of 1895. His support for the monarchy earned him a charge of treason and a 52-day jail sentence, although he was never tried. He eventually made his peace with the new government, moved to Hawaii Island, and took over management of Volcano House in partnership with his brother Demosthenes. In partnership with his former political opponent, Lauren Thurston, he worked to establish Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and the Hawaii Volcanoes Observatory. He became known as Uncle George to generations of Hawaii Island visitors, and his full name was George Lycurgus.
And Chris, we do have a winner. Judy Jacobson got the answer. She called from Haines, Alaska, and was listening online. She's a sustaining member. Thank you, Judy, for your support. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Taimani's musical journey has always been about more than playing the ukulele. From the beginning, her virtuosity on her instrument has been part of a multimedia presentation with ambitious goals. Her latest, called Elemental, has songs for water, fire, air, earth, and ether, among other things. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Tarmani.
Good morning.
From the, you've started very young, and were you always sort of thinking about a big picture presentation the way you are now?
I was always putting together shows at my house for the dog when I was five. So, yeah, I've always been in, I guess, production at a young age.
Was the dog appreciative?
He just watched and just wanted treats the entire time, so.
That's not that different.
I think he enjoyed it. I think my parents enjoyed it a little more, though. Yeah.
Well, that's not that different from regular audiences. They're just, they watch and they want treats, right?
Yeah, true. We all want treats.
So that's good practice.
It is. It is.
But, you know, the whole idea of evoking nature through your music, has that been, you know, it seems like that's been with you for a long time.
I think so. I definitely go through phases. I went through like a circus phase earlier when I was in college, but I definitely feel like there's something being channeled, and I'm not quite sure where it comes from. But, you know, growing up on Oahu and being born and raised here, it's hard not to feel inspired by the elements around you, and this new album definitely speaks about that.
It's a ready source of inspiration, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But, you know, the journey from looking at an element, a natural element, to making a sound that evokes it is a tricky one, isn't it?
I guess so. For me, that's the fun part. You know, to me, I like to personify whatever I'm playing or inspired about. So, for example, you've got water, and I like to think of it as what would water sound like? What would he or she be feeling like? And then I try and evoke the emotion that water creates for me.
Well, that's a pretty good lead into your playing that particular song. This is what water sounds like, right?
Yes. This is the fun part. So there's many different forms of water. There's raindrops, rivers, waterfalls, and so I hope you can hear that through this song. Thank you.
water.
Yes.
Yeah, I could see. That makes sense. You know, it went through a number of different sort of incarnations, didn't it?
It did. It started off with the raindrops, went to a river, and then finally a waterfall, and then the water particles falling off of the waterfall. The slow water,
yeah.
And then back into the raindrops. Yeah.
Do you do that as a solo piece? Because I know you were sort of mm-hmm. moving the tempo up and down. You have the freedom to do that when you're
playing by
yourself.
And this album, I would say half of the songs are actually solo ukulele.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely more me and a different sound.
That can be kind of liberating, you know, just as with that piece now when you wanted to speed it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of had a different kind of, created a different kind of sound picture, didn't it?
Definitely. They both have good things about them.
I definitely got the feeling of rushing water when that thing started to speed up, yeah.
Yeah.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but you had wanted to give us a taste of another
sure.
piece that had a... And I know you like sort of drone sounds,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes. I'm going to change my mind, actually.
Please.
I hope you don't mind.
You're the artist.
I'm going to play one more on my new album. I'm going to give a little taste of it because my songs tend to be a little long. But this one is Air, and this one's dedicated to the air signs. I'm an Aquarius. So this one was kind of a feeling of a Sunday. You're at the beach, and you feel that breeze at the beach on a Sunday. I hope you feel that.
I hope so, too. Taibani, I was really struck by one thing, by how different that piece was from the other one
mm-hmm.
that you played. And I could definitely buy that as a Sunday afternoon at
Good.
The beach feeling. Do you have to sort of get in that headspace when you're playing it?
Definitely. I'm a very emotional person. So it's easy for me to get into that emotion, but I definitely put myself in that situation to see what kind of emotion I feel when I'm sitting at the beach on a Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of the music that comes out.
And then having created a piece like that, do you sort of, when you're performing it, do you sort of recreate that feeling in your mind as you're playing it? It seems as if you were doing that.
I think I do. I definitely do. After 10 seconds, I kind of get into it and get into that channeled mode again.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You've used the word channeling a couple of times. You get the feeling sometimes that music is flowing into you?
Definitely.
Think
comes
yourself
from somewhere
as
else.
Sort of a vessel?
Yeah, it definitely comes from somewhere else. Not sure what is being channeled, but you just got to let
yeah.
it go.
Doesn't really matter as long as you get that result, right?
Mm.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's good to see
Thank you.
Taimani's latest CD is called Elemental. She keeps up a busy performing schedule. You can learn more about her and her work on our Conversation Facebook page.
Come on and listen. Each week on Says You, join our panelists as they recklessly explore all the nuances of the English language.
Plush can just simply be something as comforting as your wife's embrace. Plump. No, well, not. Oh, God, she'll kill me.
It's fast. It's fun. It's some of the most colorful radio on the air, Says You.
Thursday evenings at 6:30.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, expect a sound unlike any you've ever heard, with a studio visit from Tuvan Throat Singers.
Sounds interesting. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your comments. The number to do that, 792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
You can get past shows under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.